4.6 billion.
The Earth forms.
Cambrian.
542 million.
Complex life explodes.
Permian Triassic.
251 million.
90% of species die.
Cretaceous Tertiary.
65 million.
Meteor kills the dinosaurs.
55 million.
Primates appear.
2.3 million.
Pleistocene.
200,000.
Humans appear.
20,000.
Agricultural
250.
Revolution. Industrial Revolution.
60.
Great Acceleration.
The Anthropocene.
Generation Anthropocene, the program where we ask the question, what does it mean to be living in the new geologic age? I'm your host, Mike Osborne, and today's interview is with ecologist and nitrogen expert, Peter Vitusek.
My name is Zachary Brown. I'm a fourth-year PhD student here in the Stanford School of Earth Sciences, and I'm joined today by Peter Vitusek. Peter has a whole series of affiliations here at Stanford. He's with the biology department, with the Woods Institute for the Environment, as well as Stanford's interdisciplinary program in environment and resources. But I think Peter's best known for his work on the global nitrogen cycle. And we'll be getting into that pretty shortly here. So, Peter, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you.
Well, it seems like your career has really been influenced by where you grew up. So why don't we start out with some background? Can you tell us a little bit about your childhood on the Hawaiian Islands?
Sure. I was born in Hawaii and was fortunate enough to be raised in the forest above the city of Honolulu, and also fortunate that my family had some strong connections on the island of Hawaii, which is far more rural than the city of Honolulu. And then I went to high school on the island of Hawaii. So I've spent a lot of time outdoors in both rainforests and ranchlands, and had friends who grew up associated with those and remain associated with the ranchlands and rainforests. And that certainly has had an important influence on me.
So you attended college at Amherst, and you actually majored in political science
That's
while
correct.
You were there. What on earth inspired you to make this leap into the environmental sciences?
Well, I was always interested in the outdoors, and I just had some challenges in connecting that passion for something real. And it was only when I read a book for an English class on the ecology of invasions by animals and plants, read it as literature, that I saw that what that English ecologist was writing about was something that more concrete, that it was something I could do.
You described that moment during your acceptance speech for the Japan Prize, and I was struck by a phrase that you used. You said it inspired you to help make the world a less homogeneous place.
Yeah.
Could you? I really like that phrase. Yeah. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. I think as a biologist, and this is how I came to it, you recognize that there's a lot of diversity, a lot of distinction between the different areas of the world in terms of different kinds of plants and animals, different biological communities found there. And that's part of what makes the world a really interesting place. And one of the consequences of the dominance of humans on the world is that we move plants and animals with us. We change land uses to something more like a common frame than the land uses were naturally. And we bring plants and animals around that have a tendency towards homogenizing the biota of the different regions of the earth. And that is a loss. Same is true culturally, that if, you know, McDonald's is the food everywhere, you've lost something. And that maintenance of cultural diversity in different areas of the world is important in its own right and is linked very strongly to the maintenance of biological diversity as well, that distinctiveness of different regions of the world.
So why don't we get into the science a little bit, your scientific work? I might characterize you as a professor of global change. And you've really emphasized that when we talk about global change, we mean a lot more than just climate change. So humans are impacting the globe in many ways. What are some of these other impacts that we should be thinking about?
Well, there's a whole variety of things people do, not surprisingly, because after all, we're such an abundant and dominant species, as any abundant and dominant species will will do. We change the environment. But the ways we do include changing the land cover, the way land is used. Probably best estimates are more than half of the ice-free surface of Earth has been transformed by human activity. And by transformed, I don't mean affected. All of it's been affected. But this is areas that were forested that are now pastures, or that were pastures and are now intensive agriculture, or were something else and are now farms or roads. So it's a massive transformation of the land surface.
What are the primary drivers of land use change? Are we talking about agriculture? Are we talking about urban sprawl? What would be a relative number that we could put on those?
Well, that's fairly straightforward. Number one is conversion of land for animal grazing. Number two is cropland. And, of course, the two are linked to each other because so much of our product of our cropland, especially in the developed world, go to feeding animals. But those are the two biggest ones. Urbanization falls fairly far down on the list, but the challenge with urbanization is so much of the urban sprawl, especially in many developing countries, is covering prime agricultural land, which then drives a further change in the process. But the food production system is the main driver of land change.
If we dig into that food production system a little bit, a lot of our global food production is driven by nitrogen, and this really has been the main thrust of much of your work. I feel like most people recognize that we're changing the global carbon cycle by adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. People seem less aware of the impacts we're having on the nitrogen cycle. Why is nitrogen so important? Why should we be thinking about that element?
Well, nitrogen is essential for the growth of all plants, and it's essential for all life. It's the basis of protein, so we all need nitrogen. The reason it's particularly tied to agriculture is that when we grow crops, we remove the products, including the proteins we need to eat, from the land and take them off the agricultural land. Also, we keep the land bare for periods of the year when nitrogen, which is a fairly mobile element, can readily be leached through in soils and lost to stream water or groundwater or off to the atmosphere. So we basically can't do intensive agriculture without pulling nitrogen off the land. And to keep agriculture going, we've got to put nitrogen back on the land. We can't have that net removal. Not just true of nitrogen. It's true of phosphorus and other elements as well, and we have to put them back on the land too. But because nitrogen's the most mobile, the quantities we need to put back on are greatest. So to make that replacement, we put nitrogen back on the land either as organic matter, as organic fertilizers, or as industrial fertilizers, which have really only developed since World War II in any globally important sense. But their use has absolutely exploded since World War II.
When you say that nitrogen is mobile, you mean that that it is quickly lost from the soil and ends up in stream water or in the atmosphere. Is that right?
That's right. That's the challenge with nitrogen is not just that we need to produce a lot of nitrogen in biologically available forms to put back to keep agriculture going, but that some of the nitrogen we put back then moves from the agricultural fields to stream water, to the atmosphere, and it has environmental consequences in those places. It's, you know, one of the nitrogen gases is a greenhouse gas, not as important as carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas, but it makes a contribution to global warming. It drives the formation of photochemical smog, nitrogen gases do. It changes water quality, both groundwater and streamwater quality, and it's primarily responsible for coastal zone eutrophication around the world, including, for example, a dead zone at the mouth of the Mississippi.
Why don't we get into this nitrogen fertilizers a little bit more? So nitrogen is a unique element in that it's actually all around us. Most of our air is nitrogen, and yet it's not available to the plants in that form. It's not what we would call bioavailable. So how do fertilizers get past this problem?
as you say, most of the nitrogen associated with the surface of the Earth is in the form of nitrogen gas in the atmosphere, enormously abundant and completely useless to most organisms. There are a few organisms that have the capacity to what we call fix that, which means combine it with carbon, hydrogen, or oxygen and put it into a form that other organisms can use. And that process carried out by a few organisms is basically supporting all of life on Earth and has, as long as we've had extensive life on the surface of Earth. What's new since World War II is that, well, the process was invented just before World War I, but the use of it in a widespread way really became important only in 1950 and afterwards, was we developed industrial processes that can use fossil fuel energy to take that nitrogen gas out of the air and combine it with carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen and put it into forms where we can use it for fertilizer or for other industrial processes. And the striking thing is that we have some idea of how much nitrogen the natural process added to the world globally. Somewhere around 60 million tons of nitrogen that is biologically available were produced naturally every year in all of the world's terrestrial systems. And now something like 120 million tons are fixed industrially every year. So more than double the amount that was fixed naturally as recently as 60 years ago is produced industrially and distributed across the world.
That is a remarkable figure. And most of that, I imagine, ends up in agriculture. Well, what's not lost to unintended places. But that has allowed the intense and exponential human population growth of the past century.
Absolutely. The Green Revolution that brought higher levels of food production to developing countries, beginning in the 60s and continuing through the 70s and 80s, was partly the development of new crop varieties, but was also the inputs of nitrogen and other inputs into agriculture that were necessary for growth. And we can't really envision being able to feed 7 billion people without a supplemental source of nitrogen like this industrial fertilizer. Well, there are people who argue that by basically turning all our ingenuity and effort to it, we could do it barely. I don't agree, but I think it's a reasonable argument. But I think it's absolutely fair to say that we have done it by depending on that industrial fertilizer. So in that sense, I'm not one to at all to rail against the use of nitrogen fertilizer. I regard it as not only a necessity, but also one of the supreme accomplishments over the past 60 years. Now, having said that, that doesn't mean it couldn't be done a whole lot better.
Let's get into that a little bit. So you've noted that our industrial fertilizer production is more than double all natural land sources. Do we actually need to be creating that much? Is it used efficiently agriculture?
Absolutely, it's not used efficiently. The level of inefficiency with which it's used is highly variable over the world. It's really interesting to compare across different societies in terms of efficiency. If you look back at the U.S. Corn Belt, 40 years ago, we were using nitrogen fairly inefficiently in producing corn crops. Since that time, we haven't increased the amount of fertilizer we use, but we've increased our yield substantially. So that has made the efficiency better and better all the time, to the point where, you know, the efficiency on cropland in the U.S. is pretty good. The amount of nitrogen we add to keep crops growing is fairly close to being in balance with the amount of nitrogen we remove in those crops. It wasn't true 40 years ago. Now, go to the rapidly developing economies of the world like China or India. And I know more about China than I do about the others. But they're in the height of the inefficiency that we were at 40 years ago, only as China has done things, they've gotten there faster than we did, and they've gotten to a much higher level of inefficiency than we ever got to. So the efficiency with which fertilizer is used in China, that is the amount of nitrogen fertilizer added per unit of nitrogen removed in crops, is less than half of that in the U.S. And the rest of the nitrogen all goes off to the environment in various ways. And the U.S. does have problems with environmental pollution caused by fertilizers, but they're nothing compared to the intensity of problems in China.
Before we move on from nitrogen, I'd just like to hear you address this looming question, the 9 billion person question. Mm-hmm. How on earth are we going to feed 9 billion people? Can it be done, in your opinion?
In my opinion, it can be done. It is not something that can be done without damage, without continuing to change aspects of the world that matter to us. But it's not something that looms up like a cliff. It's more something that will cause damage to the life support systems of the planet, to all the species and ecosystems out there. But if we get through it as a transition, in some sense, if our population peaks at 9 billion and then decreases gradually because of people's choices in relatively wealthy economies to have fewer children, because we do make those choices, then I see the world continuing to change as a consequence, but not, I don't see it in apocalyptic terms at all. Where I see things as being truly frightening is the population doesn't level off near 9 billion or that it stays there indefinitely and then doesn't decline gradually from that peak. But I don't see us in a desperate trap that will do irreparable damage to our future, although it will change the world. There's no getting around that.
We talked about land use change. We talked about our alterations to the global nitrogen cycle. There are a number of other global changes that you've pointed to in some of your work, including our use of fresh water and also extinction, biodiversity loss. So from your perspective, do you feel that the scientific community devotes too much of its energy to climate change and that some of these other global changes that are immediate and visible and perhaps less contentious among the public, that they are getting short shrift?
I wouldn't say that we devote too much of our attention to climate change, but I would say that we devote too much of our conversation to climate change, that we don't perhaps spend enough time talking about the myriad changes that humans are causing on the Earth system. And many of them are things that people see and that resonate with people very directly. So in that sense, I think our conversation could more appropriately broaden to the suite of things that people do. And I think that the linkages among those things are clear once we're in that conversation, you know, that climate change is part of the equation, just like land use change is, just like changes in biological diversity are, and that we should be thinking about global change, these various manifestations of global change as all being outcomes of the influence of a dominant species that's changing rapidly in its impact on the Earth system.
I'd like to come back to Hawaii now and finish up by talking about the place where you grew up. So a lot of your work has focused there, both on the agricultural history and the cultural history of those islands. You've described Hawaii as a model system. What do you mean by that?
Oh, this is something that biologists make use of all the time. We find some organism, typically, that's really useful for understanding something fundamental about life. And fruit flies are one such model system for understanding genetics. The bacteria E. coli was another. And we have several others where by focusing our effort on that particular species, we learn things more general about how genetics work or how organisms develop, because that species has particular properties that makes it easier for us to understand these general phenomena. And I think islands generally, and in some particular ways, Hawaii, are model systems in the same sense, that they're isolated, bounded worlds that are true, functioning, complete ecosystems, and yet without the complexity of continental systems. So they have a lovely combination of being tractable to understanding and being complex enough to be meaningful. And that combination means that, you know, by understanding something of the island, you understand something of the world. And I think islands are good for that in multiple dimensions. I mean, many people are aware that Darwin's appreciation for natural selection and the formation of new species arose substantially after his visit to the Galapagos, where the process was there in front of him in a much clearer way than it could ever be in a continent. And he wrote about that much more eloquently than I can speak about it. But clearly, that archipelago was a model system for understanding evolution. I think in a similar way, the development of cultures on isolated Pacific islands is an absolutely wonderful model for understanding how humans interact with land. And by really trying to appreciate how a single founding culture interacts with a multitude of variation in different lands, because the people who found isolated Pacific islands found very different lands, you know, from the volcanic, fairly rich islands of Hawaii to the subcontinental landmass of New Zealand to atolls to tiny, isolated, and pretty poor in terms of soil fertility, Easter Island. Same culture found all those places. They developed complex societies on all those places. How humans and land interact is really right there on the surface in that dynamic. And what's particularly exciting about it is that the cultures are alive. You know, you aren't just studying them as inanimate things that, oh, here's how humans interact with land. You ask. And many people from the culture see those dynamics and participate in the discussion of how humans interact with land, with insight that you could never get from the outside. Now, at the same time, there's insight that comes from the outside, from looking comparatively across a suite of islands, that somebody who's embedded in the culture of Easter Island isn't going to know New Zealand or isn't going to know Hawaii, and that comparative perspective is useful. Because, you know, you can't lose sight of the fact that for the people who inhabited these islands, they were the world. You know, the island was the world, and they could see when they were filling it up and using it up. They could see when their practices were degrading the productive potential of the land. They could try to cope with that. Sometimes they succeeded, I think, in coping with that to an extent that, you know, it's remarkable by any global standards. Other times you have to argue that they didn't succeed in coping with that. But the challenge was stark, and they could see it because their island was their world. And now, in some global sense, we can see it. You know, our satellites, our remote sensing allows us to see the world and how it's changing. And can we cope with it?
And you posed the question earlier, what can we learn as island Earth, mm-hmm. so to speak,
yeah.
from which of them fared well and which of them fared poorly?
Right. I think that's an excellent question. One of the things that I'm impressed with, my understanding of many islands is based on the literature, okay, and that's inherently limited. In Hawaii, what impresses me is the extraordinary dynamism of the pre-contact society. You know, there's a tendency to look at things in 1775, just before Europeans arrived, and say, that was the society, and to in some sense put it in a bottle and say, and that's the way it would be now if Europeans had never arrived. But if you look at the trajectory of the society for the 200 years before 1775, it was tremendously dynamic. It was innovative. It found new ways of doing production, new kinds of social organization. It innovated its way out of demographic traps, much like I would say that we have so far. Would it have been able to do that forever? Well, who the hell knows? No, in some sense, you know, the population can't keep growing on a finite island forever. But would they have innovated other ways of dealing with that? Who knows? Quite possibly. But the crucial thing is that it was innovative. It was open to change, and it changed in very, very dynamic and active ways.
Peter, thank you so much for being here. Pleasure.
Thank you, Zach. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Generation Anthropocene. We want to thank all of the students and subjects who contributed to this project, and you can find the full-length interviews at our website, stanford.edu/group/anthropocene. Thanks to Maserati for letting us use their song Monoliths. A very special thanks to co-producer Tom Hayden for feedback, guidance, and inspiration. Thanks also to Julie Kennedy in the Earth Systems Program. And thanks to KZSU Studios Stanford, where all of our interviews were recorded. History is accelerating, and you're a part of it too. Where would you draw the line?